Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're enjoying your lunch. Please do continue, but we'll start the proceeding shortly. A few housekeeping items. First, of course, if you'd be so kind as to put your phones onto silent. And I would just like to mention we have a number of lunch events that are almost as fascinating as today's coming up. Tomorrow we have one of the candidates for chief executive of Hong Kong, who hasn't had his reputation questioned so far, Mr. Albert Ho. Next Monday we have a very senior journalist from Russia talking about the Russian media scene, something that I'm very interested to learn more about. And on the 29th we have Hans Timmer of the World Bank talking about their 2012 outlook for the global economy, all fantastic events that you're very welcome to come along to. Now, Ambassador Valentin Zellweger actually first came to Hong Kong 30 years ago, he tells me. At that time, he was seeing the world as a sailor. And he managed to stop here, stay in the Seaman's Mission, and also go into China then 30 years ago, before taking the overland train back to Europe. He went into the Swiss Foreign Service after that, and it was and has had a distinguished career there, including time at the United Nations and working with on the establishment of the International Criminal Court. He is currently, of course, the head of the International Law Directorate, and he will be talking to us today about Switzerland's experiences in recovering illegal funds taken from their countries. He tells me, in fact, that they first started this effort not long after he joined. I don't know whether there was a connection there 26 years ago. And today in Asia, where wealth is booming, and there was a report last year that from, I think it was PwC, that Singapore is going to overtake Switzerland as a wealth management center in a few years. We're obviously dealing in Asia with plenty of wealth creation, plenty of questions surrounding that. I think there's no better person to tell us about the experience of fighting and recovering the illegal funds that may be involved in that than Ambassador Zellweger. Ambassador, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Douglas. I'm very happy to be here, and thank you very much for providing us with this occasion to talk to you about Swiss efforts. Someone suggested just before lunch that many of you may have come because you mistook the speaker and thought it would be René Zellweger who would be speaking to you. I wish to apologize, first of all, to all those who came to see René. I'm obviously not René, and I hope I won't disappoint you. But once you're here, you will have to listen to me, and I'm very happy about that. You may also be surprised to see someone from the foreign ministry. People addressing financial center issues, financial market issues, usually hail from the finance ministry. And you may think that the Swiss government is pretty desperate sending out their foreign ministry people today to preach the gospel, so to speak, because recently there was a lot of criticism of Swiss financial policies. And of course, we're all aware of that. But I can assure you that my colleagues in the finance ministry don't even know I'm here, and it's not that I didn't want them to know, but I'm here because I'd like to talk to you about the specificity of the Swiss system, which is the so-called asset recovery, the restitution of the proceeds of crime that come to Switzerland and that we wish to send back. And the specificity of the Swiss system is that the foreign ministry plays an important role in that. And we are the only foreign ministry in the world that is so actively involved in these issues. And it also has had as a consequence, because we are supported by the Swiss government and the Swiss parliament, that Switzerland today is in a position to be in a leading role concerning asset recovery. And I do think that it is an interesting example, because we also face similar criticism about, as you indicated, Douglas, about 25 to 30 years ago, about illegal or assets of illicit origin that found their way to Swiss banks. And the Swiss government found itself in a subject of great criticism on the international level. And the interesting thing is that they really learned their lesson. And today, Switzerland is recognized as a leader in this field. And I'm certain that on this tax evasion issue, which is hotly debated today, I think we will take the same direction. As you know, the Swiss government has already come around, so to speak. We are in the process of concluding new treaties that fulfill the international standard, which is, among experts, called the Article 26 standard of OECD treaties, which is the international standard. We have concluded now treaties with double taxation treaties comprising that standard with 40 countries, among them Hong Kong, I'm happy to say. And I think we will continue down that path. We are still in the process of negotiating with the United States the, so to speak, regularization, the legalization of funds that have come to Switzerland in the past. The negotiations are ongoing. And we have also developed a model for regularizing past funds with other countries with so-called treaties or agreements on the withholding tax. We have concluded two such treaties with Germany and the UK. If we get them approved in Parliament, then I think this will serve as a model. Having said this, the topic I'd wish to concentrate, and you saw it also in the title, illegal funds are funds coming or being coming out of crime, of the proceeds of crime. What kind of crimes? Corruption, embezzlement, and theft by public official in most cases. Now, the World Bank has estimated that per year between 20 to 40 billion US dollars are withdrawn from the economies of the developing world alone. So you see, these are huge amounts, and we have to find a solution to bring them back to their countries of origin. 20 to 40 billions per year corresponds to about 20 to 40% of global overseas development assistance. So we are talking huge amounts, and there is a mounting pressure, not only since the financial crisis, but there is a mounting pressure among donor countries to make sure that the funds that they would send to developing economies do not find their way back in black, through the black market, to their own financial centers. The World Bank also estimates that out of about 5 billion US dollars that have been restituted over the past years, 2 have been restituted by Switzerland alone. And if you compare that figure, that we have more than one third of all funds restituted to their countries of origin come from Switzerland, if you compare that figure to the size of the Swiss financial center, which is seventh in terms of financial centers globally, and first in terms of offshore wealth management, also on a global scale, but closely followed by the UK, you see that the efforts of the Swiss government obviously pay off. And we have today accumulated a great deal of experience, And we are closely cooperating with an increasing number of other jurisdictions and international organizations. Just to give you one indication, the World Bank and the United Nations have created the so-called Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative, based on the premise that because these funds are so, the stolen funds are so important, there must be something done on the international level. And this STAR initiative has published a brochure at its inception, that was in the year 2007, and the brochure tries to illustrate the problem on the basis of past cases. And if you look at those cases in the World Bank brochure, they are all Swiss cases. So far, the big cases that could be resolved, the Abacha case, the Montesinos case, and other cases, they all are Swiss cases. And what I'd like to talk to you today is why we did it and how we do it. Douglas alluded to the fact that we started this policy exactly 26 years ago, and it was when President Marcos left overnight the Philippines after the People's Revolution. And the problem he faced was, or we faced, was a very typical problem that many financial centers would face. You have someone who's suspected of having embezzled a lot of money. That person flees his own country and therefore still has the possibility of moving around the funds. So you have to act very quickly. Now, the usual way all jurisdictions in the world would deal with such a case is to wait for a request for mutual legal assistance, which means that the Philippine authorities would have had to introduce criminal proceedings against their former president and then instruct the case, which means to prosecute, and send us then a request to freeze the funds, with a view, of course, to confiscating them and sending them back. But as you imagine, this takes quite a while. And the fact was that President Marcos had the possibility of siphoning off the funds from Switzerland. So the Swiss government, for the first time, within hours, decided to freeze the funds on the basis of its own power given to it by the Constitution. The provision they used is a provision that you will find in most constitutions, if not all the constitutions of the world, because in all countries, the government is entrusted with the conduct of foreign relations. And we do have a provision in the constitution that is of a very general nature, saying that the Swiss government is responsible for the proper conduct of Swiss foreign relations. And the government argued, and that's the point I'm driving at, the government argued that the reputation of the Swiss financial center is of overall importance to the well-being of Switzerland. It used the reputational argument from the beginning to take a very unusual step and freezing funds belonging to a former head of state. And the reputational argument, I think, over the past 26 years, has taken an increasing importance. And today we are convinced that in a global economy and in a global competition between financial centers, which we did not have 26 years ago, but which we have today, the reputation and the integrity of a financial center is of utmost importance. And that led to the fact that the government continued its policies and that it was always supported by the Swiss Parliament, which again is quite a feat because, as you may know, the Swiss Parliament is probably, as in many other countries, of course, split between very divergent interests. And asset recovery and the active pursuit of active asset recovery cases is an aim or an objective that is shared by all political parties from left to right. I'm happy to say it's one of the few issues where there is not much much divergence of views, and that of course gives us an enormous political legitimacy to do what we are doing. Now, if you look at the legislative framework in Switzerland, the legal framework that is at our disposal, it's not the very original one. It corresponds in its general principles to the framework that most countries know. We have a preventive tool to prevent corruption in the first place to happen, because we all agree that to recover and restitute assets is like acting like a fireman. You have to prevent the fire from starting. So preventive measures against corruption, they are of increasing importance. But once these funds or assets will come to Swiss banks, the Swiss banks, of course, like in most other countries, have a duty to identify all economic beneficiaries of the funds that will come to Switzerland. It's not sufficient just to know the identity of the guy who comes to the counter, but it's a mandatory requirement for banks to know the economic beneficiary, who really owns the funds. These are the so-called know your customer rules, and they're very tight in Switzerland. If the banks observe suspicion movements on their accounts, like in most other countries, they have a duty to report those movements to the National Money Laundering Reporting Office. And if this office comes to the conclusion that indeed it's not only dubious what has happened, but probably a case of money laundering, we will have a public prosecution. In addition to that system, which, as I said, is not an original Swiss system, we have this possibility of the government intervening actively to address the shortcomings. Because the shortcomings start after the reporting mechanism, as I just indicated. Because if something happens, and if stolen funds find their way to Swiss banks, as in the case of Mr. Marcos, then the concerned country will have to send an MLA request. And mutual legal procedures, assistance proceedings that are today globally recognized, they are of a rather static nature. It means that the victim country has to send a request to the recipient country of the money, and the recipient country then would just see whether all formal requirements are fulfilled, and if they are not fulfilled, they would say, sorry, there's nothing we can do, you have to fulfill all formal requirements. So it's a very static framework. And the experience we have made is that you need to fill this framework, so to speak, with life. I'd like to give you another example. We faced exactly the same situation as in the Marcos case, a bit more than a year ago, in the aftermath of the what is called today the Arab Spring, when President Ben Ali of Tunisia had to leave the country overnight on the 14th of January 2011, the Swiss government immediately froze his funds in Switzerland, and it froze the funds with a communication that was targeted at the Swiss banks, saying, be very careful, because probably the whole Tunisian, the cronies of the former Tunisian president, which were much more corrupt than we knew, and that is a fact that has been verified or has been corroborated since. And the government asked the banks to be very careful, and the second message was sent to the Tunisian authorities to say, look, we are happy to send back the money. If you can prove that it was stolen, and if you cooperate with us that it was indeed stolen. And we cooperate since then with both countries very actively. We have sent several expert missions to other countries. We have convened conferences to try to understand why things may not work. And you have to see also that these cases are of an enormous complexity. If I take the Tunisian example, the Tunisian authorities, if I may say that, they have very professional prosecutorial authorities, but there were few corruption cases over the past 30 years in Tunisia, for obvious reasons. So there is relatively little knowledge about asset tracing, about prosecuting those cases. So what we tried to do was to send asset tracing experts, prosecution experts, mutual legal assistance experts, to assist them in drafting the request. I'm happy to say that today we are in a full-fledged mutual legal assistance procedure, and we hope to be able to send back the money. Of course, that will take some time, and expectation management is one important part of our work. Everybody, first of all, expects these sums to be enormous. In each and every case we had so far, it was always talk about billions of US dollars. We had no case with billions. The biggest case we had was the Abacha case, the funds of the former Nigerian president that were found in Switzerland, and they amounted to 680 million US dollars. But the second expectation that we have to face which is almost more difficult to manage, is that the concerned population say, look, it's very simple. The money was stolen from us, and you just have to send it back. You have found it, just send it back tomorrow. And of course, we then have to explain that we have a rule of law, that we have to fulfill the legal requirements, and that only a judge in the end can send back the funds to the concerned countries. And what we observe is that those concerned by these procedures, the former heads of government or the former ministers, of course, they still have enough money to pay excellent lawyers. So each and every decision and I see my colleague from Hong Kong nodding his head, each and every decision that we take is appealed against, and they always go up to the Supreme Court. And the problem is that this takes time. So we have to do an enormous communication work in Egypt and in Tunisia to try to explain these facts. Now, we are still very confident that in the end we will be able to send back the money, because in both countries we are able to count on very competent authorities. That is not always the case. In many cases, corruption, heavy corruption, goes together with frail institution. If you take another prominent case that we had in Switzerland, the case of former President Mobutu in the Congo, I think it's a good example of an autocrat who ruled the country ruthlessly for decades and who wrecked the institutions. And when the new Congolese government sent us this mutual legal assistance request, they were no longer, so to speak, in a position to follow up, to prosecute Mr. Mobutu, who was still alive, and then to be actively involved in mutual legal assistance proceedings. In the end, I regret to say, we had to give back the money to Mr. Mobutu because the Congolese government did not help us in finding ways to be able to give it to the Congolese population. And if you look at this in a more general perspective, it means that the very person who is responsible for the weak institutions in his country was also the main beneficiary, because we were no longer able to send it back to the country, but we had to just liberate the funds. They were again accessible to the family. We had a second case, and the second case is still ongoing, and perhaps overall it is a more interesting case. It's the case of former President Duvalier of Haiti. Duvalier left the country in 1986, and like in the Mobutu case, the new authorities send these MLA requests for help in recovering the money to many different jurisdictions. And like in the Mobutu case, all the other jurisdictions had to end the proceedings because the Haitian authorities were not in a position to follow up, or to prosecute Duvalier and to send the request that we needed. Those familiar with the history of Haiti know that Haiti went through extremely difficult times. And in the end, we had to stop the proceedings, like all other countries. And in that case, the Swiss government came in and said, look, it is not right that, again, like in the Mobutu case, the person who is responsible for the wreckage of the institution would also be the main beneficiary. And the Swiss government then decided to submit a new act to Parliament, which would allow us in the future, in such cases, to confiscate the money without any assistance from the concerned country. We now have this act. It was called, in an article published in the US magazine Foreign Affairs last summer, probably the toughest act against autocrats in the world. We are now in the process of having the first proceeding, and we expect the decision in the Duvalier case this year. We will see whether the law withstands the test of the judges, because the law is based on the premise that is criticized by some jurists. Because it is so difficult to prove the illicit origin of stolen funds, what the Swiss legislator did, he said, we reverse the burden of proof, and we have these people prove the licit origin of the funds. So we are now in the judicial proceedings leading up to that. A Swiss judge will have to decide on that. And if the government succeeds in being able to confiscate in the end, it will have to send back the funds to benefit the Haitian population. Let me conclude by saying that tax evasion issues, which are today on high on the agenda of many countries, are just one side of the coin. And the other side, and probably at least of equal importance, is the question of proceeds of crime that have to be repatriated. And we are happy to work with other financial centers to see how that could best be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We have some time for some questions, so I will open it to the floor. If you could indicate, and someone will bring a microphone to you, if you could also introduce yourself before you ask your question. Do we have any questions for the Ambassador? Right.
Michael Linton-Smith. The cases that you've cited where the government basically had to give up because they couldn't get any assistance from the country that had issued the request for mutual assistance. What then happens to the funds? Yeah, what happens to the money? Does it stay with the bank in Switzerland, or where does it go?
No, what happens is there is a freeze on the money. And if we can no longer cooperate with the government concerned, we have to lift the freeze, which means the funds are just available for those who have a title on it. And just to give you an example, Mobutu left the country, was overthrown in 1997. Then the new government immediately sent us this request, and then we froze the funds. In 2009, when we had to finally unfreeze the funds, and perhaps it's interesting to know why we had to do that, what we had offered the Congolese authorities was, because we understood that they are not able to prosecute Mobutu, we offered them to prosecute him on the basis of a Swiss provision in Switzerland, but we needed, of course, their agreement. So we hired a Swiss lawyer, and he started the prosecution, but then the Congolese government prohibited him from continuing, and that was probably due to the fact that the son of Mr. Mobutu was the first prime minister of the Congolese government. And that led to us unlifting the freeze. And just as a bitter afterthought, I got a phone call on the day we had to lift the funds from one of the banks concerned, and they told me, we have here someone who identified herself as a daughter of Mr. Mobutu, and she wants to lay her hands on the funds. Can we really give the funds? And at least I could say, you cannot today, you have to wait for tomorrow. But the next day, they had to do so. And it also shows that these families, they are very closely watching what we're doing. And because the Mobutus knew that in the end, we could not confiscate the funds without the help of the Congolese government, we just had to wait. And that is bitter.
My name is Merle Linda Wolin. It seems that your work, unfortunately, is always sort of cleaning up the mess afterwards. I wonder if you can tell us what Switzerland and what the Swiss banks could do to prevent these kind of funds from always finding their way to Switzerland to begin with. And is the country or are your banks taking action to do that?
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, what we can do to prevent the money from getting into Switzerland. I think it's safe to say that the Swiss government is determined to prohibit black money from coming into Switzerland. You could then argue that there are still funds. Of course, we know that. And I tell you frankly, I don't think we will ever achieve a state where there are no more black funds. We are the biggest, at least for the time being, and Douglas alluded to it, that Singapore may overtake us. For the time being, we are the biggest offshore banking place in the world. You cannot exclude that you have. What you can do is you can be as strict as possible. And I do think that things have changed over the past few years. Now, Switzerland is, of course, not the only country that has black funds or black assets. Many others, but they are much less vocal about it. If I take the case of President Abacha, for example, from Nigeria, there's a World Bank report indicating that the bulk of his wealth went to other financial centers. But Switzerland was the only center that really repatriated the proceeds to Nigeria. There is a recent World Bank report that was published in December last year that came to the conclusion that most stolen funds are not in Switzerland. We came in, I don't remember, but certainly we were in, I couldn't tell you. It was a report about so-called legal vehicles that help you to shield stolen funds by trusts or this kind of stuff. And the jurisdiction that was identified as being the most active and where most of the funds were located, and this is the World Bank report, are the United States. And Switzerland came in, I couldn't tell you exactly, but we came in at a... So there is also a fact that, and this is an issue we have to deal with in Switzerland, many people criticize us for being so active, or criticize the government, because they say the more you're active, the more people will talk about it. And I give you a good example. In the case of Mobutu, as I indicated, the Congolese authorities sent out 10 requests for mutual legal assistance. They sent out one request that led in one country to the freeze of $1 billion. When the Congolese did not add up on that, and this country had to end mutual legal proceedings, they just lifted the freeze. Nobody talks about the country. Everybody talks about the one country that really tried to come up with a creative solution, that said, that's not the right way. You don't give the money to those who are responsible for the sorry state of the country. So it's always a downside to what we're doing. On the other hand, I think it's increasingly recognized that the Swiss government would really employ great efforts to clean up the financial center. The problem we have, and I'm candid about that, is the issue of tax evasion, which came up also in the aftermath of the financial crisis when governments had, and I understand them, had to maximize their tax revenues. But again, the Swiss government has come around, and what we now expect is that other financial centers will clean up their act.
And that still has not been the case.
Just a slight follow-up. Is the root of the problem the fact that you still have secrecy, that Switzerland still has secrecy laws for these bank accounts? Is that the root of it?
No, it's not. First of all, banking secrecy does not apply to crimes. It does not apply if you have a prosecution for corruption, for embezzlement, or for theft. There is no banking secrecy. Banking secrecy applied until recently, it's finished now, for tax evasion. And that hurt us a great deal. And I'm not going now into giving you a long explanation, but it is also due, there is an explanation, a Swiss explanation to the fact that tax evasion was excluded. We do have a Switzerland, Swiss people have a natural reticence from having the government look into our own bank accounts. So the banking secrecy for tax evasion will only continue to apply for Swiss citizens resident in Switzerland. But it will no longer apply to the others. And if you allow me to add a personal remark, I think that the banking secrecy was also a bit overstated, the importance of banking secrecy, because it's a long time ago that we abolished banking secrecy for any criminal prosecution. But the mistake we committed, we had these number accounts. And I think a number account is an extremely catchy term. Everybody has a very clear picture of a number account, which also leads to the fact that in almost every James Bond movie, you would have a sleazy banker, and all the sleazy bankers, by pure coincidence, in James Bond movies, they're Swiss bankers. It's much more difficult to imagine what a trust is. What is a trust? A trust is a very elegant way, because trust is a we all have a positive connotation with trust. It's very nice to trust people. But the trust is a legal vehicle that allows you to extremely efficiently hide the origin of your money. And you cannot pierce the veil of a trust. Now, nobody talks about the trust. And I mentioned this study of the World Bank because it's not such a catchy term. To speak about a number account is very easy. But to explain what a trust is and how it works is much more complex. And I think that explains, at least in part, why there's much less talk about it, although you can prove that it's probably a much more, it is for certain a much more efficient way to hide your money.
We're at 2 o'clock now, and I see a couple more people who are interested to ask questions, perhaps quite a few, perhaps maybe Ambassador, they might be able to come up to you afterwards, but if the audience would indulge, one final question. Can the two of you agree who will ask the question?
Thank you. Simon Young. You've given us the figure of 1.7 billion Swiss francs returned to countries. And I'm wondering if you can give us two more figures. The first figure is, of course, I think the general rule is that not everything gets returned. It's usually dictated by principles of sharing. So can you tell us, in any particular case, what's the percentage of the actual total proceeds that would actually be returned? Is it 50%? Is it 60% or what? And the second figure I wonder if you can give us is, again, you don't have to return. There may be no victim. It may be there's no MLA request. So what's the figure for the amount that actually goes to the Swiss government, that gets confiscated and goes to the Swiss government?
Thank you very much. On the corruption issues. Well, look, it's simple. Of course, you're right. There is a sharing possibility if you have a clear victim. On corruption, we don't share. We pay back almost 100%. There is one single case, the Abacha case, which was extremely complex, which asked for or required an enormous amount of work from the Swiss authorities, because in parallel to the MLA proceedings, there was a Swiss prosecution that took an enormous amount of work. It was a very complex case, and there I couldn't tell you how much it was. It was a very small amount, that we withdrew, and it was more for political purposes because we wanted to indicate that we had given our share to making it a success. But our base, our premise is that corrupt or stolen funds are stolen, and we are not going to take any advantage out of them. Where we have sharing is in drug cases, where there could be that drug authorities between different countries share the proceeds, but that's done in transparency. We have a legal basis for that. That requires us to negotiate with the other country. But in general, there is nothing that is that stays in Switzerland. The position of the Swiss government is very clear. We're not going to take advantage of stolen funds from other constituents, from other jurisdictions.
Ambassador, thank you very much for coming and telling us about Switzerland today. If you have some time and people would like to follow up, yep. Thanks very much again.
Thank you very much.